we had the consulate in Nagasaki, and they were all sent. They were all only the very necessary people were kept on. And when we left, the consul's wife and family had had to go, and they went to Hawaii, and there was the consul, and I think a vice consul there or a young man, just a very few. They finally had to get out, but I guess mm-hmm. they got out mm-hmm. in rather a difficult situation. But what came down from the State Department and so forth didn't affect us as being directions as to what to do. And we were finally, when we were told to leave, it came through our Board of Missions. Mm-hmm. It was the Board of Missions.
Well, now, you mentioned that they had, the Japanese had put up signs with the
spy signs.
What was supposed to be the effect of this? To warn people not to spy, or
to
warn
talk.
That you were being spied upon?
No, to warn the people that they mustn't talk, that they weren't supposed to say anything they thought to foreigners or to anybody who might possibly be a spy. Mm-hmm. And that was, I guess, the idea that you couldn't trust anybody too much. Mm-hmm. Then they were having these calisthenics. All the children, schools, and even the towns would have, early in the morning, calisthenics. And people were supposed to go out and do these calisthenics in the streets to make them stronger. And that was done in the schools, too, quite vigorously. And that was true after the war, too. They continued with that kind of thing, which was no doubt good for them. Because, you know, the old-fashioned Japanese woman never stood up straight. She hunched over. And, of course, tuberculosis was very common disease. But then they began to get the idea that if they were going to be strong, they were going to have to be take better care of their bodies. So they did, and the girls nowadays just stand up there. And the interesting thing is that since the war, the average height of the girls has had increased when I left, about an inch. And part of that was their standing. But in our school, when we got new seats for the college girls, we had to get them larger than the seats that we already had, because the girls were bigger than they had been, and they were uncomfortable in the old seats. So that begins to point out the value of physical education and awareness and posture and such. Yeah.
Well, what about propaganda?
Against us, you mean?
Or? Well, the general radio and other mass media, newspaper propaganda concerning what they were doing and what.
Of course, we didn't have a radio in our house. We did have radio, but it was in Japanese. And unless you were very fluent, well, you couldn't understand it too well. So we didn't hear too much of that. We got the English printed newspaper from Osaka. But that didn't have the propaganda in it that the Japanese papers had. But they had plenty of propaganda in them.
Well, anti-American propaganda just the glory of Japan?
Well, the glory of Japan and superiority of Japan over everybody else. And, of course, this, what is it now? One roof and four and eight pillars or something like that. They had this idea that all these different countries would come under the roof of Japan. And it would be, they would help to hold up the superior Japanese people, you know. Oh, there was a lot of that kind of business. And the idea that the Japanese could just walk in and take over Asia. Then, of course, they began to get some, and they did at first, you know. They went clear down into Indochina.
Did this have any real effect in your school with the attitudes of the students?
No, it didn't seem to. Except as it did generally, you feel the same kind of attitude that the general population had. But for us personally, we had no antagonism shown to us as individuals.
Not even in the latter days, right there at spring of 40, when they had you to withdraw, you hadn't had any.
No, when we left, it
experiences
was
with soldiers coming in.
Oh no, we had no trouble with soldiers. Now Miss Curry, who stayed on, she had she after the rest of us left, they thought it was better for one of us to stay on, and she was one who could stay. She had no reason for coming home, especially, and so she stayed on for a while, with the understanding that the president of the college, who at the school, who at that time was a Japanese man, a very fine Japanese man, that he would tell her if it was embarrassing for her to be there in the school. As soon as he felt that there was antagonism to the school because there was a foreigner there, but she would leave. Mm-hmm. So she stayed on until finally he told her, he called her in one day and said, I think it's better for you, for the school, if you leave now. So she did, and then she had a terrible time trying to get passage home, because there were the military police and the civil police, and they were working against each other. The civil police wanted her to get out, but the military police wanted her to stay, almost in a hostage idea, I should think. And when she had passage on a ship that was going to Shanghai, so that she could get out from Shanghai, and she was called into the military police, and they kept her there while the ship went out. So she finally was able to get out and get to Shanghai and get home on the last ship that went across the Pacific from Shanghai. But of course,
this was just before Pearl Harbor, probably.
Just before Pearl Harbor. Mm-hmm. I don't know exactly when she got home, but anyway. She was there quite late, and she had stayed on in the house with one or two of the servants. There were seven of us lived there at that time.
Were any of the Japanese able to take over for y'all when you departed, as far as teaching
keeping the school going? We had a woman in the English department who was a graduate of one of the good Middle West colleges, and had 8 years in America, and her English was just as good as ours. And then we had several others whose English was good, and we'd been training people. Now, for instance, one woman had been sent to America for home economics, but she was able to take over, you see, in that field with Japanese people. And the Japanese were beginning to get good training in various things themselves. So that was then of course in the educational system they were using the school children for manufacturing purposes, and instead of going to school, they go to school maybe once a month or once or twice a month and get some training and school work, but the rest of the time they work in the factories, the clothing factories making uniforms, or all in these arms factories and so forth, and so that they didn't really have very much schooling during that period. And some of them felt very badly after. They were graduated from a junior college, but they didn't know anything.
Sounds like our situation here in the United States today.
Yes, it does. But this was a different reason.
Yeah, right.
So there was that... that feeling among the people, and of course they were indoctrinated with all kinds of. And when we went back, the classes that we taught were the first classes that had real education. Mm-hmm. You see, and of course then there were Japanese teachers. We had, well, as I told you, we had about 80 Japanese teachers in the college and the high school together, and many, many students. So that was one of the things that we had. That was rather interesting, I think, because of this electric situation that I spoke of before. We asked people to send us boxes of candles, used candles. So they did. And we were able to have, this is after the war, we were able to have APO privileges for a few things. Now that was a come and go sort of a privilege, because whoever was the leader, American, in charge of Nagasaki, would change his mind, or somebody else would come in and have different orders. But for a while, they were able to have the APO. Mm-hmm. And so these boxes could come in of candles, thousands of candles.
Hmm.
We had 1,300 girls in the high school, outside of the girls who were in the college, three-year college at that time. So at examination time, we give out candles. The little girls got the short candles, and the seniors in the college would get the big candles. And then they were smart enough to get several of them together and burn one candle, and they'd study. And then when that candle was gone, I'd have somebody else's candle.
Mm-hmm.
So we had these boxes and boxes and boxes of candles coming. And that was one of the things we had to do. Then we had also boxes and boxes of relief clothing, some of it very good, very nice. And we had, and then when Miss Peckham, who came back, 1950, I guess it was, when she came, she had a good half ton at least of relief clothing. So they decided that was for the teachers in the school, and the kids were given choices. But first the teachers could choose, and they had a point system. And for instance, it'd be 50 points for a coat, and maybe 30 points for a dress or a man's suit or something or other. So each teacher had so many points. If she wanted to take it all out in a coat, okay. If she wanted to take it out and divide it up, why, she could. I don't remember how many points they had or what they were, but anyway, that seemed like as fair a way to distribute the things as possible. So we were able to do that. And then the governor was a short, fat little man. And I received, my sister's friend's husband died, and he had been a short, fat little man. And his wife said that she had this beautiful black suit. And she said, not many people here want a black suit. So they sent it out to me, and we discussed it among ourselves. And then we asked the governor's interpreter, whom we happened to know, if the governor would accept such a thing. So he said, well, I'll go ask his wife. So she did, and they were delighted.
Mm-hmm.
So we sent the suit down, and he put it on, and it fit him, except that the sleeves had to be shortened a little, and the trousers had to be shortened a little. But it fit him perfectly.
Huh.
Oh, yeah. Were they delighted? They came up to our house, the governor and his wife, and thanked us, and then when the strawberry season came, they sent us a big basket of these beautiful strawberries. And so that was a very pleasant connection that we had. And then one of the other people, Miss Olive Curry, received a suit that had been her brother-in-law's. It was a brown suit. And the mayor of the city needed clothes, so somebody asked if he would be willing to accept it, and he was delighted. So he got the brown suit, fit him perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
And then people would send us shirts from America, and I don't know how many shirt collars I turned and cuffs I fixed and passed them out, take the tail of the shirt and cut out a new collar, you know, and sew on a new collar. And here was a new shirt for one of these men, even for the governor. We gave him a couple of made-over shirts, so forth. So you see how desperate people were.
Mm-hmm.
You go downtown and the stores had nothing in them.
Were they even open and trying to function?
Yeah, they were open. Maybe they'd have a couple of bolts of khaki cloth on them. And that was the only kind. No other colors were available. And you had khaki if you had anything. And they made over their clothes. Oh dear, it was just pathetic. The things the girls would have to come to school in.
I can imagine there at the end of a war like that everything is just completely.
Yes, and nobody has taken time. They didn't have time. They had to stand in lines for all kinds of food. They had to stand in line for this and that and go for these calisthenics. And they just didn't have time to keep house properly or to take care of their clothes properly. Then those beautiful kimono that they had were made into what they call mompei, which were kind of a trouser-like thing that fastened around to do their work in, because they were safer in time of fire. If there had been a fire, he's flying kimono, you know, his loose kimono would have been more dangerous. So they did all their work in Mompei. Even their beautiful kimono they made over into Mompei. So it was really pathetic. Now, are there some more questions that I can answer, or have I?
I think we've covered things fairly well.
Okay.
Well, don't you? I think it's been fascinating.
Well, I'm glad if it was.
There is one thing that I wonder about. When you arrived, of course, in the Philippines, and you were there in Manila during 40 and 41. Did December the 7th of 41 have that much of an impact upon your situation?
I should say so.
I didn't know whether you already realized that the Japanese were moving against Philippines before that.
That was the 8th with us, you know. And among the girls who were there to go to university, we had a few high school girls. And among them was a girl whose parents were both doctors and worked in one of the mines. You know, the gold mines were the big thing right around there. And so this girl was in high school, and her parents wanted her to get ready to go back to America. She was a mestiza girl. Her father was a Filipino who had met this woman, met this American woman in college, and they were married and then went back to the Philippines. So we had this mestiza girl. Well, in the morning, I I read the newspaper, but I hadn't had time to listen to the radio. And in those days, we got up and had our breakfast and our devotions, and schools and everything started at 7 o'clock because it was so hot in the middle of the night. Well, this particular day, I was going about my work, and somebody came and said, what was her name? Ines? Eunice. Eunice has mumps. Well, I went and looked at Eunice, and all bulged out. So I sent a wire to her family immediately, and I isolated her. I didn't want a house full of measles of mumps. So I isolated her up on the fourth floor. Well, then the woman who was this Australian woman that I spoke of who was helping me came in, and I told her about Eunice, and she said, well, things never happen singly, do they? And I say, what else happened? Then she told me about the Japanese coming in at the north. Well, of course, a lot of our girls came from up that way, and they were just frantic. They didn't know how they were going to get home. Well, they'd gone to school in the morning and had this news told to them. Japanese were invading, and they came back to
the house. So it was not until that date that you realized that there was an immediate danger.
No. It was the same day as Pearl Harbor, you see. But naturally, we didn't have that. And so I didn't know what I was going to do. But anyway, then it was we started this business of trying to get the girls home as much as we could. But these people, then in the middle of the morning, the mother came for this girl, because she'd gotten my telegram, but she, of course, as soon as they knew about the war, they wanted to get their daughter home. So she had come, and I greeted her at the door with a say, oh, I said, I put Eunice up on the third floor. Well, that didn't mean anything to her, but it did to the girls. And I said, you can go up and see her if you want to. I knew her mother was a doctor. So she was astounded. She didn't know why her daughter would be put up because she hadn't gotten the telegram. So finally we got that straightened out, and she took the girl home. I don't know how they got there, but anyway, they got home. So all that day the girls kept coming in, and what were they going to do, how, and so forth. So then I had to consult with the other members of the mission. Fortunately, there were some close by, and we decided that we'd try to take care of the girls as much as we could, as long as we could. And let them get themselves out of there. But oh dear, that was then bombing after bombing happened right on through Christmas, as I said. Then after they'd entered the city, there wasn't any more bombing for some time until the Americans came back and began. But oh, that day I'll never forget it. That was the we didn't know where to go for safety, and there were places designated in the university building. We were right across the street from the university. And so we organized the girls, and the ones who wanted to go could go over with one of the people who worked in the house to these air raid shelter places, which were down in the ground. I mean, in the basements of the buildings. So, but gradually they didn't want to go. They said, it's so noisy over there and people are screaming and yelling and we don't think we're going to be any safer there than we are here. So they would just stay and not go over, although they had a chance to go.
So you knew that the Japanese were invading Luzon Island before you even heard about Pearl Harbor, huh?
Well, yeah. Well, I guess we heard about Pearl Harbor, too, about the same time, because this Australian woman told me then, of course, what had gone on, and then I could hear on the radio as much as I had time to listen for. And then we had...
A time of great uncertainty, wasn't it?
So the girls came and went, and we tried to console them as much as we could, but there wasn't much we could do. And then we'd have these other girls come in who were perfect strangers who had no place to go. And the YWCA was next door to us on the other side. The church was on one side and the YW over there. So we could send some girls over there because they were in charge. They had a Filipino woman at the head of that institution that was seen as safer. And they kept open all through the war as long as they were. But the Japanese took over our house for their girls who were sent down as stenographers and people like that.
Oh.
And they took over our house, and the woman in charge, the Japanese woman in charge who came, said that she had, she'd been living in a place where there were lots of people to use the bath, and because she was in charge of it, she was the last one to use the Japanese bath. You know what a Japanese bath is like. And she said, oh, and I thought I'd come down to Manila, and I'd get into the Japanese bath first, because she was to be the head of this place. And that position is very important. And she said, I got down here and we didn't have any Japanese bath. We had showers. But they had Japanese baths put in for them when we found out later that the Japanese had their own Japanese baths. Mm-hmm. But, oh dear. All the experiences. Mm-hmm. I'd forgotten some of these details until they began to pop back into my mind.
They do become vivid again, do they not?
Yes, they do. But I had tried very hard to forget as much as I could.
I'm sure that.
I mean, you can't hold a grudge, and if you remember things, why? It's hard to give up a grudge, or it's hard to forgive and forget unless you can forget.
Well, first. Did you really at that time have any animosity against the Japanese?
I myself? No, I had lots of Japanese friends. But I did have against the military system.
Against the government.
Because you could just see it. They were debauching the people, really. Mm-hmm. But as far as the individuals
were
concerned,
I meant against Japan as an entity rather than against the people.
Yeah. Well, of course, we did feel a sort of sadness that they were so gullible. People were so gullible, and that they were so high and mighty in their own thinking. You know, they were, well, Dai Nippon, Great Japan. And it was Dai Nippon about everything. They don't Dai Nippon so much anymore. But for all those years, it was Great Japan, the first Japan. So, it was
the same thing that Hitler did in Germany, of course, with his master race.
Yeah, that's it, master race, and they were going to take over all of Asia and run it. So they got what they asked for. Mm-hmm. And of course, China was pathetic.
What did you miss most?
Well, I don't know. Maybe the general feeling as I walked down the street that I was different. I was the foreigner.
The security of being at home.
Yeah, and the security of having your own kind of people around you all the time and being understood. Very often you didn't know whether they really understood what you were trying to express. You see, and that made it a little different to be sure you were saying what you meant to say, and not something that could be construed in a different way. I think that was one of the difficulties that we felt. And I know I made some blunders in that score.
You didn't miss any of the, I don't want to say luxuries of home, but such things that
sure
you're accustomed
did.
To, such as neighborhood drugs, soda fountains.
Well, that didn't bother us so much because
I was just using that as an example. Or as a,
yeah, but what we did was now Nagasaki, although it's in the same latitude as Savannah, is a very cold place because it's so damp, you see, right up over the bay. And it was cold, and we lived in a house that was huge. It had been the American, well, it was built by a German doctor originally, but it had been the American consulate. And the two rooms on either side of the, it was the colonial style, Southern colonial style, graciousness, and great porches all over. But the inside, this wide hall, and our hallway was wide enough so we had meetings and simple concerts and things like that in our front hall. For the foreign community and others. And we had then on either side were these great big rooms, a living room on one side and dining room on the other. And the dining room was so large, they were the same size, but the dining room was so large that we had two full-size tables that suited 12 apiece that could be used in the dining room, lengthwise of the dining room, together. So that was a good-sized room. The beautiful French windows. Oh, it was a lovely room. But the only way to heat it was with a little fireplace. 15-foot ceilings. We used to say we wish we could hang ourselves from the ceiling. And the same way with the living room. But we did get a heatrola, you know what that is, for the dining room. So we kept the dining room fairly comfortable. In my room, I had a small room, and it had a little pot-bellied stove in it, so that the maid would come in the morning and light the fire and put a tea kettle on top of it so I'd have hot water to wash it.
Coal fuel primarily?
Yes. Nagasaki has coal mines under the bay, and so we could get bituminous coal. It wasn't ever cheap, but it was there. And we could have it. We couldn't use it freely. We would have a fire to dress by in the morning. And we'd have a hot bath, a Japanese-style bath, where you heated the water, you know, and then you'd do your washing outside at the tub and get in to get warm or relax or something. We had that. And then several of the other rooms, mine was the smallest room, and some of the other rooms were very large and had just little fireplaces. Or little pot-bellied stoves or something like that. Yeah. So we were really cold all winter. And clothes, I wore more clothes. I'd wear a wool suit with a sweater under the jacket and a bigger coat on the outside. Beside all the extras underneath, too. Wool stockings. Oh. Yeah. I used to say I felt like a powder pigeon. I guess it looked like one too. But everybody had the same. I mean, nobody had warm home. That was one of the things that we missed, was the comfort of heat. One of the young girls who came out after the war said, I never knew what they meant by a poor standard of living. She said, I thought it meant that, well, people didn't all have cars or they didn't all go traveling as they pleased. She said, when I get here and find out it means you're actually cold or you're actually hungry, she said, I could hardly comprehend. That's what a low standard of living means. And of course, Japan was high compared to many places.
In fact, I had not asked you about the poverty or anything because I always considered Japan as several notches above
well,
China.
Well, it is. Much above China. However, there are, of course, the desperately poor people, just as we have them here. And the but education had been fairly general, so that you had an intelligently trained populace. They knew something. Now, like the farmers in China, if you read The Good Earth, you know how ignorant they were. Well, the Japanese weren't that ignorant, even the farmers and the people in the lower classes. But they were desperately poor in many ways. It was one of the hard things that we had to try to relieve, and yet the problem was so big it was hard to relieve it.
This is the end of the interview with Mrs. Helen G. Moore.